You're listening to Conversations on Strategy. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. This episode is part two of a two-part series about the monograph Deterrence Gap, Avoiding War in the Taiwan Strait, which was published by the U.S. Army War College Press in January 2024.
Joining me today are Drs. Jared M. McKinney and Peter Harris, along with Colonel Rich D. Butler and Josh Arostegui.
McKinney and Harris are authors of Deterrence Gap, Avoiding War in the Taiwan Strait. McKinney is an assistant professor of international security at the Air War College at Air University, Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama. He directs the Taiwan Deterrence Research Task Force at the university. Harris is an associate professor of political science at Colorado State University. He's a non-resident fellow with defense priorities. Butler is the director of the China Land Power Studies Center and the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College. Arostegui is the research chair of the China Land Power Studies Center and the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College. Welcome to Conversations on Strategy. The expectation that the PLA has the chops to both control Taiwan and reap rewards of economic capability easily needs to be reversed. How does perception matter? Do scorched earth policies need to be externally stated, whispered in small groups, or just believe as probable?
Peter and I are political scientists who study deterrence, war in East Asia. We don't make policy for the U.S., much less for Taiwan, but we can speak to what we think is needed for robust deterrence. And if the PRC thinks it's going to have a cakewalk in Taiwan, that ultimately might even be profitable economically, you're not going to get any sort of deterrence. Resistance, scorched earth, scorched tech, long-term insurgency, are not comfortable topics. But I would ask this, would Russia have invaded Afghanistan in 1979 if it believed or knew that it would result in 70,000 casualties and eventual withdrawal? Would the U.S. have invaded Iraq in 2003 if our decision makers and generals assessed that it would have cost 36,000 casualties and $2.4 trillion, which is like $6,000 per U.S. citizen at the time? In other words, is that a cost that we would have assessed as acceptable? And the truth is that I think people would have thought differently, Russians in Afghanistan and the United States in Iraq, if we had a good estimate of the actual cost. So that goes to the communication and the preparation point. For deterrence to be robust, the PRC has to be convinced that even if it so-called succeeded and occupied Taiwan, it would face a merciless prolonged resistance campaign that undermined PRC power. This is simply the people of Taiwan fighting for the idea of Taiwan. And the more able and willing they are to do this, and the more they communicate that ahead of time, the more robust deterrence you're going to have, and paradoxically, less risk of war. I could just say that lots of people have criticized Peter and me for saying things that make them feel uncomfortable, like that Taiwan should threaten to blow up TSMC if China were to invade and try to take it. People said we were warmongers, that we didn't care about Taiwan's economy, that we were naive, that we didn't understand China, which didn't care about economic issues. But we thought this is all so much noise. Either Taiwan is going to impose costs on invaders or it's going to do the opposite. And if we're talking about allowing the PRC to waltz in and achieve massive technological gains, that's not deterrence. If you want deterrence and if you want to avoid conflict, there's only one right answer. And I think we're willing to say that, even if that annoys some people.
I've heard our critics of our original Broken Nest article say, discussion of disabling or destroying Taiwan's chip industry is off base because it would cost the global economy a lot of money. And they talk about the huge numbers and sums that would be wiped off global balance sheets as a result of Taiwan taking this dramatic action in response to an invasion. My response is always, yeah, exactly. It's a high cost that Taiwan has autonomy over and has control over and can threaten to follow through on in the event of a Chinese invasion. The point is that the threat is costly, that it's severe, it's an economic nuclear bomb. Taiwan has got sovereignty over, has got control over. And as Jared explained, if that cost is high and if the threat is made credible, and I think it ideally should be, to answer the question, externally stated as well as whispered to Beijing. If Taiwan can make that threat seem credible, I think it does dramatically lower the odds of Beijing assessing that invading Taiwan is worth it or is even doable. The counterfactual is this. If Taiwan says the opposite and says, oh, in the event of an invasion, we will move to secure our chip manufacturing industry and make sure nothing should befall it and happen to it, would that strengthen deterrence? I think no. But I think the threat to disable this very valuable node of the world economy does add to deterrence. Is it sufficient? No. It needs to be done in conjunction with other strands, layers of deterrence across all dimensions of power. It's a tool that's available to the Taiwanese to dissuade Beijing from invading their island. And I think it's a tool that they would be wise to utilize.
I thought that was well worth the price of entry because it's easy to get hung up on the way you wrote about that in the article. But ultimately, you're tying it to the entirety of you can't afford to digest the island. The challenge, obviously, for leadership in Taiwan, the quote you used was one of the generals or one of the ministers saying they'll never get the golden egg because we're going to win and it's going to be a hard fight. And how you explain that so your citizens and your business leaders understand that is challenging. But I agree with the explanation you guys gave, because there's a recent study, I want to say it was from Stimson Center, that articulated that the minimum impact to a war on the global economy would be at least 10% drop in economics. I think it's probably greater than that, especially if it's protracted war, which obviously for planning purposes, you shoot for, because if either side thinks they're going to win easy, that's a go indicator sometimes, particularly for the CCP. At risk of repeating myself, I think that's a very cogent and logical thought.
And in case the listeners have not read the Broken Nest article, I highly recommend it. I had to reread that again after reading the most recent deterrence gap piece, and it was even more eye-opening this time around. So thanks.
I actually got some inspiration a few years ago when I was working with Broken Nest on Peter from the three-body problem Chinese science fiction series, because I don't know if you guys have read that, but basically it's a story of deterrence, and it's a story of deterrence failing because a group of people weren't willing to say harsh things. And they became fearful to deter an invasion because it seemed pretty nasty. So ultimately, not to give it away, but it failed. But there was an alternative. And the alternative required thinking the unthinkable, to go back to another Cold War discussion. I think when we talk about things like scorched tech and a prolonged resistance, mountain warfare, these are like thinking the unthinkable today, unless you're willing to actually build some capability and some credibility on those ideas, you're reducing deterrence.
The U.S. Army Pacific, along with other U.S. services and Indo-PACOM, has emphasized the building of its relationships with allies and partners as a counter to Chinese military dominance in the region. You note that the U.S.'s global system of alliances and partnerships gives it superordinate reach, and that in the context of a Taiwan conflict, the U.S. would draw upon these alliances and partnerships. How specifically do you think those nations would support the U.S. during a Taiwan conflict?
Jared and I support the current U.S. policy, the Taiwan's Relations Act, which obligates the United States to retain the military capacity to intervene in East Asian war, to retain that capacity and capability. The United States' network of allies and partnerships in East Asia is one way that Washington retains that capability. So, speak for myself, I certainly support the maintenance and the strengthening of America's existing alliances in East Asia. Some of those allies and partners are more valuable than others if it came to conflict in the Taiwan Strait and if leaders in Washington determined that it was in the U.S. national interest to enter that conflict. Japan in particular, I think, would find itself very quickly on the front lines of that war, not least of all because there's a chance PRC leaders might decide to preemptively strike U.S. bases in Japan rather than waiting for the United States to make a determination about whether or not it would enter the war. So it's very clear that the leaders in Japan need to have contingencies in place and long-term planning in place with their counterparts in Washington for what they would do in the event of the war. And it seems fairly inconceivable to me that the United States would enter that conflict without Japan entering the conflict. They'd both be chain ganged together in that respect. But what I would say too is that America's regional allies and partners probably need to do more to strengthen their own deterrence in the region and to strengthen their own capability to dissuade China from overturning the political and territorial status quo in East Asia. regional states have got a direct interest in preserving the status quo. It's their security and economic prosperity that's on the line if China were to make a move on Taiwan. So they have a powerful self-interest in stopping that from happening. I don't think that many states in the region have got the sufficient military power to threaten China with military punishments in response to an invasion of Taiwan, but they can certainly do more. And they can do more to make clear what they would do in the event of a Chinese attack on Taiwan. And while the United States can help to upgrade the militaries of its allies, I think we need to move towards a situation where there's more of a rebalancing taking place. That instead of viewing US allies as through the lens of basing rights, we start to view US allies and partners through the lens of them taking more of a role in upholding the deterrence regime in East Asia and making credible threats against the PRC about what would happen in the event of a move on Taiwan. It might not all be military reprisals. I think it's unrealistic to expect every state in the region to join a war in defense of Taiwan, but there's certainly political, economic punishments that could be inflicted that I think need to be discussed. And again, this is thinking the unthinkable. This is kind of nasty stuff to be considering, but the United States does have this network of allies and partners who could and should probably do more to make clear what their response would be to a move by Beijing to overturn the status quo.
If you watch all the services, and I'll focus in on the Army in the Indo-Pacific, the ability for them to go in and go into other people's sovereign terrain and integrate and do exercises with them include showing deterrence value against what Chinese may try to do with their military against Taiwan, all has a critical value. Plus, maintaining a network of sensors and common operating pictures and the ability to understand what's going on in the environment depends on being in with those other countries so that we can have not just the access, but the ability to see and share information. To Peter's point about asking the hardest questions, I think there's two hard questions. Peter alluded to the idea, buy into your own defense. How do you want the United States to integrate into that, that supports both your defensive needs and collective self-defense as a coalition? Because we don't have a NATO alliance, but we certainly make a coalition. And I think that coalition changes early in a conflict. You rely on your allies and closest partners to do things early. But as the conflict becomes longer and more protracted, we may be asking second order and different questions about what do we do now that we've stalled the CCP thought was going to be a fait accompli in the island of Taiwan. That's a very different set of questions about what do you do next.
From an integrated deterrence, meaning across the dime field perspective, some people suspect getting into how Taiwan is allowed to integrate with the free world adds deterrence as the free world learns to bandwagon with itself. How far can we recouple Taiwan into the international order to build deterrence?
This is one of the areas where I start to get quite pessimistic and cautious. So I think there probably are ways that Taiwan could be integrating more into the international community and the free world, in particular, the democratic family of nations. I would certainly caution that Taiwan and the United States, insofar as we have influence over leaders in Taipei, should tread very carefully. Integrating Taiwan more into the free world, however that might look, might not strengthen deterrence if it provokes China into invading the island because it leads leaders in Beijing to conclude something like the United States has resolved to move Taiwan towards political independence or formal independence or something like that. So while I wouldn't rule out the possibility that there are ways to integrate Taiwan more international community that don't contravene our commitment to maintain only unofficial ties with Taiwan, my big takeaway would be that we have to be cautious, that we do need to maintain only unofficial ties with Taiwan, and that we should be alert to the possibility that too much political integration or formalized integration could be a bad thing, both for Taiwan and by extension for the United States.
I just add to that, some recoupling moves I think would clearly make sense, like Taiwan being able to be observer at the World Health Organization again. Not only does it make sense pragmatically, but historically as well, because from 2009 to 2016, it actually was an observer. That would seem to be in line with precedent. And so there's some areas where probably some pressure would be worthwhile. But there's going to be limitations on so-called coupling to international order due to the fact that Taiwan isn't recognized as a state. And this is probably further exacerbated by Nauru withdrawing recognition and then maybe potentially others going forward. Probably prudence and sensitivity are the most important things when we're talking about coupling an international order. And maybe some places Taiwan can be sort of pragmatically welcomed, but other places maybe would cause more harm than good to push.
We've allowed the Chinese to make Taiwan walk away from many organizations besides traditional nation state voting memberships. Places in the UN as observers is a case in point. I would think that reversing that by doing a little gray zone work, open international order, sends a deterrent signal to Beijing that we're serious when we say we want stability and peace and that you can't forcefully take the island. There's some room in here, particularly based on the way that Taiwan handled the pandemic a couple years ago and how they were very open and persistent and helpful to the international community. And it's much more than the measure of how many countries recognize you. They're down to 12 or 13 now. They have a place to play on the world stage as part of the order, and we should maybe take a little bit more advantage of that to help instill resiliency and resolve.
There's a perhaps too optimistic but creative way in the future that Taiwan could be more integrated into international organizations with the consent of Beijing and the willing participation of Beijing. And there's some precedent in the sense that the Soviet Union had a seat in the United Nations as the USSR. But Ukraine and Belarus also had representation in that international organization. So one sovereign entity, but more than one seat in terms of participating in an international organization. So there could be a creative way in the future. I don't think we're anywhere close to it now. Even those who subscribe to the idea of one China could be open to the possibility of two seats. Again, I don't think Beijing is open to that at present. But moving forward, it's not outside of the realms of possibility that we could see multiple seats for one China. However that might be finessed, I don't know, it's way above my pay grade. I wouldn't rule it out as a way to strengthen the status quo and bring the two sides together.
If you have any concluding thoughts you'd like to share, I'd love to hear them.
I'd like to just stress that deterrence is imperative today, but conflict is not inevitable. And even though there's no obvious solutions on the horizon between now and 2049 or after, the truth is, if you think back to what China looked like in 1900, 124 years ago, or what it looks like today, we've gone from the Qing Empire to the warlord period, the Republic of China to communist China, Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening. We've seen so much change in 120 years. It would be maybe naive to expect no more change in the future. And so I think there's always the hope, and certainly on historical precedent, the possibility for the evolution of ideas and institutions. Long term, I think if we can maintain peace, then there's a lot of hope. The pressure is whether we actually do that between now and 2027, and then between 2027 and around 2030 or so. We're talking 7 years. And our bottom line recommendation is we have to optimize what we're doing. Taiwan has to optimize what it's doing. American allies and partners have to optimize what they're doing for a shorter deterrence timeline. What this means, AUKUS submarines in 2045 aren't going to help you. B-21 bombers in the mid-2030s might not necessarily help you either. What can you acquire, train to, and communicate on a short timeline? And if you can do that, then there's a chance, I think, we can hold things in balance.
My concluding thought would be to contrast what we argue for in the deterrence gap monograph, which is this layered approach of multiple interlocking deterrents, with what some other people argue in favor of, which is US strategic clarity. There's this argument out there that the best way to deter the PRC is to make it clear that an invasion of Taiwan would result in World War III with the United States of America. And Jared and I have engaged with people who've said the only way to deter the PRC is to impress upon them that with certainty, the PLA and the PRC would be ground into the dust by the United States as a result of invading Taiwan. That kind of a threat saddles the United States with an enormous commitment that would have to be followed through on, or reneged upon. Either way would be kind of calamitous for US interests. What we argue instead is that there are credible threats, severe threats, that are capable of dissuading the PRC from invading Taiwan, that do not saddle the United States of America with an unambiguous commitment to fight World War III. And I think that is a major takeaway of our text that I would like listeners and readers to think about. They may not agree with what we say, but I would hope that they would look at arguments for U.S. strategic clarity with a little more skepticism as a result of having read our text.
I really appreciate you guys taking the time. The article was fantastic, the monograph. I really did appreciate that you guys took the time to answer questions that most people tend to just not get into. Those hard questions that, as you mentioned earlier, it helps create a lot of discussion. I get people messaging me that have read your article and asking, what do you think about this? And I said, hey, man, I'm not going to interpret it one way or the other. I think they're asking questions that we all need to really take very seriously. Thank you for taking the time from my end.
I appreciate the fact and look forward to even more discussion and seeing more of your thoughts as you think about this deeper. Because you're not just illuminating the problem. You're actually making logical, coherent, well-researched and analyzed recommendations and putting them on offer for people to consider. And I applaud you for that. And thank you.
Thank you both. Let's do it again.
Yeah. Thank you both for your time. I really appreciate your insights and questions were fantastic. So thank you.
Jared, Peter, Rich, and Josh, thank you for making time to speak with me today.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, SSI Live, and A Better Peace. Listeners, you can download the monograph at press.armywarcollege.edu/monographs/964.